Came across a phrase the other day, which I think captures the spirit of America today. It appeared in an article by Samuel Huntington, who teaches political science and government at Harvard. He labeled our mood a democratic distemper. A distemper means foul humor, being out of sorts. It suggests the friend I spoke to the other day, and when I asked what he felt about the current presidential campaigns, his answer to me was as little as possible. When Americans have gone to the polls during this campaign, in the states where primaries have been held, less than half of the registered voters have bothered to exercise their franchise. And less than 80% of those who are potential voters in those states are in fact registered to begin with. And when the public opinion survey people have gone out and asked, why don't you bother to vote? Why aren't you voting? The answer comes back in some such word as these. It doesn't make any difference. My vote doesn't count anyway. Whoever is elected, when they're elected, they will do whatever they want to do. The sense of a unity, of a union between the governors and the governed seems to have been ruptured and lost. In 1958, at the University of Michigan Survey Research Institute, asked Americans whether or not they felt that the government acted for the benefit of the common weal, the common man. And 75-76% of those who were asked indicated they thought so. When the same question was asked in 1972, only 38% of the respondents answered that they believed that the government acted basically for the benefit of the people. In 1958, a similar group was asked whether they thought that the government essentially told the people the truth, the facts. And at that point, only 23% answered that they thought that the government rarely or never told the truth to the American public. In 1972, that number had doubled to 48%. Now, Jimmy Carter is a man of many warm capacities. But the sudden surge of his presidential aspirations can hardly be explained by these alone. He seems to have won the hearts of America largely because he's not been involved with Washington, because he's not been among the power brokers. And this despite the fact that he has been a state governor, and the state government has been seen in America as the least responsive, the most lobby-ridden agency or place of government of any that we have. But if you have not been part of the city of Watergate, the city of the Pentagon, the city of the CIA and FBI headquarters, somehow in America today, that's a great plus, a great statement in your favor, such as the distance, the distrust between the governed and the governors. Now, I don't know any greater change in the American spirit than that which has occurred in the last generation or two, from the time when Americans were calmly and quietly confident about the American way. If there were problems, all we had to do was to roll up our sleeves and use the traditional American know-how and ingenuity and a bit of sweat, and we'd solve the problem. And it was firmly believed that American ways and American institutions were the wave of the future. We would solve our own problems internally, and in little by little, the world would come to realize the benevolent quality of all that we had. That was very much a part of the American spirit, that set of attitudes only two generations or so ago. But when is the last time you heard an American say that American ways and American institutions represent the wave of the future? How long has it been since we said to each other, you know, we're on the right path and the world is following us? Or we are solving our problems domestically, economically, and socially. This past week, those who support Governor Reagan for the presidency bought an expensive half hour of national television time in order to give their candidate a chance to express his views on many issues. The governor chose to deal largely with the military issue, and he charged that the Henry Kissinger, Gerald Ford administration was responsible for having made America a second-level power militarily, and that Dr. Kissinger was content to allow American power to be second to Russia's. Now, I doubt that many Americans are as preoccupied as the governor with firepower and military technology. But certainly most Americans have wondered about the inability of the American giant to make its will known throughout the world. A few Cuban soldiers and a few tribal soldiers are able to have their way in Angola, you know, whatever we may feel. And more than this, I think we've all been saddened by the way in which America's good name and American institutions are publicly and easily and constantly being vilified and across the world. Now, to what shall we ascribe this democratic distemper, whatever its causes? We're prone to label these causes Vietnam and Watergate and the FBI-CIA exposures. Now, Vietnam is an American tragedy. It's a brutal, costly war, costly in men, costly in materiel, costly in morale and national divisiveness. During that war, the American government lied to the American people and lied to the representatives of the American people again and again as to its plans and as to the progress of the fighting. They were conducting the war for our benefit, presumably, but we were not told what was happening, what they had in mind. And Watergate is a national tragedy. Watergate involved administrative abuse of power and misuse of power and obstruction of justice. And there was no better way to signal the existence of this I-they, this distance between the governors and the governed, than the existence in the White House of an enemies list, a list of Americans whose opinions did not agree with those of President Nixon and his followers, who were therefore put on, placed on an enemies list, and all of the powers of the intelligence community and the Internal Revenue Service and other government agencies were there to be used against them. When, in fact, in quieter and calmer times and with an administration that was less paranoid, these people would have been labeled simply the loyal opposition. Now, Watergate, Vietnam, exposures of corruption in all of the institutions of our government are important indications of distance, surely. But I would submit to you that they're not the basic cause. They would be saddening. They would be incidents, but not a disease, evidence of a disease, unless something more basic had occurred in the framework of our national life. And I think it is this, that by and large, we have become disillusioned at the ability of our government to deal with the pressing economic and social problems domestically, to deal with the pressing security problems internationally. Americans have lost faith in the governors and have lost faith in the ability of the institutions of the government to respond to pressing need. We are, in a sense, leaderless, or we feel ourselves to be. We are disillusioned. We were an expectant people. The greater the expectation, the greater the distemper. When I first returned to Cleveland as an adult 20 years ago, no one really bothered to lock their cars, and I suspect a few really bothered to lock their homes. And today, there's hardly a home which does not have on the door one of those little stickers which indicates that some electronic surveillance is at work. The other night, I was out walking our dog, and suddenly three police cars with their lights blazing pulled up in front of a neighbor's house, and the police piled out with guns drawn. And the incident represented no more than the fact that the man in the house had accidentally tripped the electronic equipment. We live today in a city which is far more crime-ridden, far more accustomed to violence, far more defensive against violence than was the case 20 years ago, a filthier city, a city where there are fewer services such as we once took for granted. When I returned, Liberty Boulevard was still a lovely park in which children played, and now it's an extension of the city dump. And wherever we live, whoever we are, Americans look about themselves and they feel that the standard of life, the standard of living, not their income, but the standard of living, the amenity of life, has diminished. And they wonder about the soaring rates of crime. They wonder about the falling rates of reading capacity shown by children in our school. They wonder about the inability of social welfare programs of the government to deal with poverty and to reduce it and to eradicate social ills in the ghettos from our cities. We seem to be unable to confront the problems which face us internally, and we seem unable to exert power effectively to establish security for ourselves in the world. Now, it's not as if America had not tried. In 1949, it's estimated that the average American worked a little over a month a year to pay his taxes. In 1976, the average American will work nearly 4 months a year to pay his taxes. Americans have been willing to pay great sums of money to the government in order to solve these domestic and these international problems. In the late 1940s and early 1950s, there occurred what the economists call the military shift, the defense shift. We moved from a few short years of peacetime to the Cold War and to a position of military readiness. And Americans became accustomed to paying 5, 6, 7% of the total gross national product for military hardware and military equipment and for a standing army. That percentage rose during the height of the Vietnamese War to 13%, it's returned to about 7%. But since 1950-51, the American people have been willing to pay their hard-earned labor in order to provide adequate strength for the society, for the country. And as they look about themselves, they wonder whether, in fact, they have got what they paid for. And then, beginning with the Kennedy administrations, there occurred in our national budgeting what's called the welfare shift. When, because of the creation of vast programs of public welfare, of income maintenance, public housing, urban renewal, Head Start, the programs which were designed to provide medical care for the ghettos, the programs which were designed to provide recreation for our cities, the programs which would provide legal aid for the poor, as all the Fair Deal programs began to come, the word I think is on stream, Americans willingly began to pay the cost, the price, in taxes for these programs. First it was 5% of our gross national product, and then 6, and then 7, and now 8, and it's rising above 8. In Cuyahoga County alone, this last year, in 1975, over $500 million was spent in income maintenance programs. And the problem is that when any one of us drives downtown along Chester or along Woodland, we do not see tangible, visible evidence of the success of these programs. Now, there are some who say it's been pouring money down an empty hole. And that's, of course, nonsense. Many have been helped, and many have been healed, and many have been housed. And our domestic problems would be far worse if these programs had not been in existence. But Americans have not seen the results, the positive, clear results of these programs of social reform and of income maintenance. And unfortunately, our government promised us results. Somehow our government always thinks in terms of a war, and people have a habit of thinking that after a war, there's victory, that you win a war. There was the Cold War. And we provided our military with great firepower and strength in order to win the Cold War. And then there was to be the war against poverty. And we provided these agencies of the government with money to wage the war against poverty. Now, when a civilian population faces a long war, morale sags, the will begins to flag. It becomes less easy to see an end to the struggle. And that's precisely the position, I believe, in which most Americans find themselves. There have been results, but the results have been largely invisible. It could have been worse. Tangible results are not clear for many to see. The headlines are still ominous. There is a great deal of unrest. American power seems to be in retreat. And domestically, we do not seem to be able to get into the problem of the ghetto, to get into the residual problem of those left behind in the center city, to reduce the rise of crime, to increase the effectiveness of our educational system. All of us have seen the photographs of public housing projects which have been ransacked by those for whom they were designed. There's been so much evidence of failure that it's been frustrating. And the American people have gotten into what Huntington called a democratic distemper. We've been accustomed as a nation to quick results. And we're in a long, long, long struggle. And we're unhappy that there have not been quick results. And unfortunately, our political leaders promised us that those results would be certain and that they would be quick. If I were to analyze the democratic distemper, I would analyze it in spiritual or religious terms. There are two ways, really, of looking at history. One way is the Eastern way and the Greek way. History is, in a sense, a spinning wheel. There's change, but no progress. There's motion, but no movement forward. That which has been is that which shall be. That which has been done is that which shall be done. There's really nothing new under the sun. All the rivers flow to the sea, but the sea is never filled. The Greeks, the Indians, most people of the world take an essentially pessimistic view of the human condition. There are long cycles of changeful cycles, but somehow life always comes back to the basic problems of want and inadequacy. There's always frustration at the end of the cycle. And there's another view. It's the biblical view. It's a view of history which is linear or messianic. I read to you this morning from the second chapter of Isaiah. Our tradition believed that there's an end of days. And beyond the sorrow of the day, there comes an end of time when every man shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and none shall make him afraid. Now, in the classic Jewish tradition, this messianic age comes through God's intervention. In the classic Christian understanding, this messianic age comes again supernaturally through the second coming. Neither Judaism nor Christianity has basic to it a belief in progress, that little by little we are building the basis of a better world, that we can engineer and sculpt and architect and build the kingdom of God on earth. That's God's work. There was an essentially optimistic attitude about the future, an attitude which I believe to have been fundamentally life-saving. But then in the 18th century, man began to feel that he could, in fact, create progress, that with his research and with his learning, through the library and the laboratory, through his medicine and his art, and most of all, through his industry and industriousness, men could achieve here on earth the kingdom of God by their own efforts. Men no longer talked of the Messiah, but of the Messianic age, of a secular version of the biblical concept of history, the biblical hope. And as man began more and more to convince them, men began more and more to convince themselves of the real possibilities latent in man, a new optimism swept over the world, began in the Enlightenment. And that optimism was most surging, most apparent here in America. Here in America, we were not under the heavy hand of the past. We had no tradition of class or of caste. We had no traditions of guild or of feudalism which had to be overcome. This was a pristine land, an open land, an abundant land. Here a new society would be built. Here a new man would emerge. Here the future, the foundations of the future were being laid. America in the 18th century and the 19th century was a remarkably optimistic place. Those who talked of America as a society of the future, the model of what is inevitably to be worldwide. We were confident. There was nothing we could not accomplish. God had been gracious to us in this continent, and we here were building a new society. We were proving that, believe it or not, democracy could work. The Greek philosophers had denied that possibility. The mob could not be trusted. But here we put our trust in people and in the Constitution, and we created a republican system of government, and it was working. And here we were limiting more and more poverty to smaller and smaller segments of the population. Confidence surged. The messianic spirit was abroad in the land. And then, in our century, really in our generation, beginning with the Depression and extending into the Second World War, America began to sense the essential tragic nature of life. What was it Job said, that man is born unto trouble as the sparks that fly upward? Suddenly life became problematic, and the future became uncertain. Yes, we had research, and in our laboratories we could create life itself, but we could also create the instruments which could destroy all of human life. And yes, we had medicine which could sustain life, and we had increased the lifespan. We had also increased the numbers, the millions of those in our world who would suffer from malnutrition and near starvation. And yes, we had created an industry which was capable of creating vast amounts of good to raise the standard of living of millions of people. But that same industry was spewing forth pollution, which was destroying the air and the water and the very land on which we lived. And that very industry on which our success and our abundance depended was eating up at an unconscionable rate the natural resources of our earth. Suddenly, man was no longer as confident as he had once been of himself, that is, of his future. And when, after the Second World War, the evidence began to become apparent to all of us that America may not, in fact, be the wave of the future, that America was not all that it always designed and deigned and claimed itself to be, that we were not the good society we like to think of ourselves of, that there was a black community that had been denied their rights, that there was racism and prejudice of the worst kind within the body politic, that there was an other America of 20, 30, 35 millions of people who were not within the circle of American opportunity. As we began to discern the new range of problems, our native optimism reasserted itself. We would create a new society. We would create a fair deal. We would create new social welfare institutions which would somehow solve all of these problems as we had solved all the problems that had faced America before. But now, for the first time, many of these problems seemed intractable, insoluble. They were not easily resolved in any case. And Americans became more and more frustrated. We became more and more uncertain about ourselves. We sensed more and more that somehow there was a distance between us and our expectations, and we projected that frustration unto the governors. We began to damn them for their inability to solve these problems, and the distance which has grown up in America between Washington and the people emerged as to the condition it is today. Now, if I were to diagnose the democratic distemper of which Samuel Huntington has spoken, I would say that it is an equal blend of a loss of faith and of self-pity. The self-pity is childish, peevish. When someone comes into my office for counseling and the problem is not a real problem in the sense of being one where they really need help, they say to me, "Why me, Rabbi? Why did this terrible thing happen to me?" I'm often tempted to say to them, "Why not? Whoever told you that your life would be a life of endless sunshine and happiness? Why should you alone of all the mortals that have ever been created escape loss or escape loneliness or escape the anguish of disease? Are you immortal among mortals and immortal among mortals?" And the sense of religious loss is a more difficult one for Americans to deal with. But I think we again have to ask ourselves a question. Were we not, for most of the last century or so, idolaters? Were we not worshiping false gods ourselves? Had we not turned man, the doctor, the Nobel Prize winner, the ideal of man, into our gods? And now that our gods can no longer produce the miracles which we constantly expect of them, are we not, in a sense, breaking the idols and searching for new gods? And if we are, should we not turn back to where the God really exists, to the one God? Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom, the Bible says. Let not the rich man glory in his wealth. Let not the strong man glory in his strength, but let him glory who would glory, glory in this, that he knows and understands me. Now the rich man in America has gloried in his wealth, and the strong man in America has gloried in his power. And the wise man in America has gloried in his wisdom. And all of that glory has resulted in what we see around us. A society of some ability. A society of many accomplishments. But a society which seems incapable to live on what it has achieved, which wants utopia. Is it not time to turn back again to the one God who is the source of promise and of hope to the world? The God who tells us it's not yours to complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it. That you will live as Moses and the children of Israel lived on the way, and that like Moses and those who came out of Egypt, you will not get to the promised land. That your generation and the generations that come out after you will be generations of responsible effort, of which much will be demanded, who will have to learn to live with insecurity, who will be taxed heavily for the social needs of a community, who will be constantly frustrated by the inability to find panaceas, quick, easy solutions and remedies to the social problems of the day. But if you have faith, if you're willing to persevere, if you have the courage to carry on, then truly you can do much, and much more will be done by the generations that come after. The democratic distemper is a mood and not a judgment. The democratic distemper, I believe, overstates the falterings and the failings of our American society. I know of no society on earth where there is so much freedom and so much education and so much opportunity. We are a society with law and with freedom. We are a society with social consciousness and of freedom. We are a society which is just learning to live with the city, to live with a philosophy of no growth, and to live with the restrictions which ecology places upon industry. We are a society which has come far and accomplished much in a very short time, comparatively. And if the will does not fail, if the willingness to sacrifice for the common weal does not desert us, America can grow in the sense of amenity, in the sense of goodness, in the sense of social order, in the sense of decency and humanity, and become an even better society than perhaps we dream of today. But it will not be easy to achieve this, and much will be demanded of us. And most of all, much will be demanded of our leaders. Really, the only time that I lose faith in America is during a presidential campaign. When I hear intelligent men most of whom I believe to be honorable, promising the American people that which they know no man can deliver to the American people. I wish someone would campaign for the presidency or for any other high office and talk of sacrifice and only of sacrifice. And talk of the things which we cannot hope to accomplish now. And talk of the need to develop a lower standard of expectation. And talk of the need to think in terms of community, and not simply in terms of my pocketbook. But apparently no presidential campaigner believes that he can garner votes in this way, and is left up to some of us in the pulpit and elsewhere to speak these kinds of words for himself, for those he loves. The American spirit has moved beyond optimism. The American spirit has moved into an era of democratic distemper. I pray that the spirit of America will outgrow this unbecoming and childish self-pity, that we'll find again the courage to carry on, that all of us together may move into the next 100 years of our nation's history with lowered expectations in a materialistic sense and much higher expectations of ourselves as citizens. Amen.